Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, Paul.
Of all the shows you have ever done, this one has got me the most excited.
I thought it was just me being in the room.
Well, that always, you know, that just gets me excited anyway. Okay. I'm just glad to see you.
Too much.
My buddy.
but you know what?
I don't get excited.
It is really funny, right? Because we're just talking to our guest today. I'll introduce in a minute, but we're just talking to him a minute ago and saying that, you know, how these episodes have turned into, you know, Paul special, you know, therapy session or, you know, reflection session.
It's supposed to be your life, not my life, but it's become more about my life.
It's the Rad Life, but, you know, Paul lets me call it that. Right? and I thought I had you stumped today.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the exact opposite. Right?
You got me pegged today.
I had you pegged today. So without further ado, we're going to
avoid the banter.
Avoid the banter and be gentle with our listeners this week and not do our normal riff. I do want to introduce my guest, and the gentleman's name is Terry Sweeney. And are you a retired captain?
Yes.
Okay. So and U.S. Marine Corps, right?
Yes, sir.
U.S. Marine Corps captain, retired, Terry Sweeney. And he's here today because there's something to do with this week in August, okay? We are commemorating 71 years of the end of World War II, not officially, because there was a signing
of the armistice with
the Japanese, I think, in September. It was the first
event
week of September.
The event
that brought the war to conclusion.
This is the event that brought the war to conclusion.
The dropping of the atomic bomb.
On Nagasaki.
Yeah, the second city.
The second city. And why Terry is here is because he is the son of the only gentleman that actually flew both missions. The dropping of, I'm going to get this wrong, Little Boy on Hiroshima and Fat Man on Nagasaki. I got those right?
Yes, good. Sir.
Right. And one was a hydrogen bomb and one was a plutonium bomb.
That's right. Correct.
And so there's a few things that I was surprised talking to Terry a few minutes before the show about that I don't know that are common knowledge about how that all transpired and what led to it and, you know, kind of activities that the military took.
Well, we'll get into that.
But we'll talk about that. Yeah. But I want to introduce you, Terry. Terry, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And your father wrote a book about this experience. And let's plug the book and his name and everything here.
Yeah, it's called War Is End by Charles W. Sweeney and is available on Amazon. It's out of print, but you can still get it. Libraries are now dispersing them throughout the country, so you can get them for a fairly cheap price.
And he stayed in the military, unlike most of the bomber pilots, and rose to be a major general. Is that what it says?
That is
there?
Correct.
Wow. Okay.
And this is, you know, going back. This is 1945, right? That this particular mission is. So I'm going to turn the mic on to you because I know there's a lot of ground for us to cover here. I want to really know about, you know, how did your dad find himself in that situation? Because I think that's an interesting story in itself.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just say that. When I said that I thought I had Paul stumped so that people have a reference here while we're listening to Terry, and yet I had him pegged, is because, Paul, take the mic. Why did I have it?
My father, like his father, was a bomber pilot in World War II. Now, my father passed away a couple of years ago, but, you know, in the end of his life, not so much in the early part of his life, really talked a lot about those years. In the beginning, he didn't want to talk about it too much, but as he got older, he actually joined the 8th Air Force reunion group and met up with his crew that had scattered, that he had lost contact with for 50 years in the 90s. The survivors all got together, and he became very vocal about talking about it and much more open to sharing these experiences, some of which were very funny, some of which were unbelievably horrible. And so I became fascinated with World War II because of hearing my dad's stories and my dad's involvement.
Okay, so thank you for that.
And the irony is,
just to frame it this way, you know, both of your dads were probably very young when they were doing this, right?
In their 20s, yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, your dad, Terry, was, what, 25 when he flew that mission, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So tell us how he found himself in that position.
Okay. Well, I was, we're from Boston, and what I tell people is the real Irish come from Boston in the United States.
You hear that, Paul?
Yeah, we're not from Boston. We're the fake Irish.
We had, my parents had 12 children, and four. Two died before I was born, and two died after in the last 4 years. So we're now down to eight, but we're still going strong. However, back in 1937, and I know that's going back for a lot of people, and some people, you can't even recall 1937, but my dad graduated from high school, North Quincy High School, just outside of Boston. And my dad, Charlie Chuck Sweeney, used to go down to a field called Denison Field. It was an old Navy base airstrip,
sure,
right in Quincy, and he would ride his bike down there and just watch the airplanes fly all the time. And one day, they had a fair down there, and the pilots were offering rides for $2 to go up and circle around the Boston Harbor, and $2 was a lot of money at that time, especially for an 18-year-old kid. But he scraped the money together, and that day he knew aviation was going to be his life.
Wow!
And at 18, he never had been or never flown an airplane in his life, and 7 years later, he dropped a nuclear bomb that ended World War.
Wow. Wow. That alone, just say that again.
Yeah,
within a seven-year period of time, he went from
never being in the cockpit of an airplane to dropping the last nuclear bomb on this earth that ended a world war.
Well, shaping the course of human history, basically. Forever.
Absolutely.
Ever-changing.
Yeah, absolutely.
War and history and everything.
Wow.
Yeah.
So to give you a little background, Dad enlisted in the Army Air Corps when a lot of his friends were going off to college. And his thing was he wanted the nice leather jacket, the watch, and,
exactly.
Who doesn't? And the sunglasses.
Right. Who doesn't?
You know?
And to be a flyboy.
And that was his main goal. And when you had all three of those, women were easy to attract. And,
that's what my dad used to say. I don't know if that's true.
Having been a Marine aviator myself, I can concur with that.
Okay.
But anyway, on September 6th, 1941, Dad actually earned his wings. Well, they pin on your wings once you've completed flight school, and he was sworn in as a second lieutenant in the Army Air Corps.
Mm-hmm.
The very next day, the day that was called the day we live in infamy,
right,
Pearl Harbor was attacked.
Yep.
And, of course, what did they need? Pilots.
Yep.
So he was already trained and immediately was sent off to a weapons testing site in Ohio, but they realized that they needed more experienced pilots down at Eglin Air Force Base. Eglin Air Force Base is in Florida, and that was the gateway, if you will, of planes coming in and out of the European theater.
Mm-hmm.
So he went down there, and he was in charge of he was a group commander of one of the squadrons down there, many squadrons.
Now, let's stop you. So right away, your dad is a second lieutenant, and within a short period of time, he is a group commander because they don't have any pilots.
Well, I saw something, and I can't remember. It was somebody who was talking about the book, maybe one of your brothers, or it was a quote somewhere from your dad, but something about the fact that he pretty much wanted to fly anything that had wings.
Well, and he did. he flew every single plane in the inventory, which at that time were 60 airplanes. And my dad is what I would call a natural pilot in that, you know, some guys are natural ball players.
Mm, sure.
or he could get into a cockpit and just fly it.
Figure
by
it
seat
out.
Of the pants.
Yeah.
Figure it out. Unlike me, who had to study and
learn it
and, you know, fly multiple missions of the same task just to get it down. He could do that in one flight. But he was the base commander. He was
pretty rapid acceleration. Because
of the
war.
They needed experienced guys, and they needed to train these guys.
Right.
And so he's down at Eglin, and he got word from his boss that there was a special plane coming in and to square off a section of the tarmac where no other planes could go, no other people could go.
So secret.
So a very secretive plane was coming in. And so he went up to the tower to watch to see what it was. And he described it as the most beautiful plane he had ever seen in his life. It was a B-29, never seen a B-29 mm-hmm. before. So he immediately jumped in his staff car, which was a Jeep at that time, and drove over to the airplane. And, of course, it was Colonel Paul Tibbetts who was in charge of the entire Manhattan Project.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they exchanged pleasantries, and my dad told Colonel Tibbetts that, you know, anything he needed on the base, he would be happy to drive him to, take him to, whatever. And, of course, in the back of Tibbetts' heads, he said, you know, you just want to fly my airplane. And he said, well, you're right, sir, but we'll get to that later.
And let's stop for a second because the B-29 was special because it was the first pressurized cockpit.
That's right. And well, that was one of the many things about the
B-29. Would allow it to fly at a higher altitude so the fighters, the Zeros and stuff, could not fly that high.
Could not reach that high at that time. That's
so,
correct.
Whereas the other bombers that were in existence, like the one my dad unfortunately flew, the B-17 and the B-24, they'd put a mask on when they got to a
That's
certain
height. That's right. Yeah, at 10,000 feet.
But they were able to shoot them down. They were able to go up and the fighters could fly that high and the flak could...
That's correct.
Shoot that high.
That's correct.
So the 29 was a huge jump.
Oh, and it was beautiful. It was just a beautiful. It was called the Cadillac of airplanes at that time. So my dad put his spies out around the base and follow this guy wherever he goes, and I want to know where he is at any time. So he finds out that after a few meetings that Colonel Tibbetts is going to go to the officers' club for dinner. So my dad happened to be showing up at the same time. All set up. And he said, hi, Colonel. I'm Captain Sweeney. I met you earlier at your airplane. And would you like to have dinner together unless you're with somebody? He says, no, I'm not with anybody. So they had dinner. And my dad convinced him that, you know, he should let him have a try in his airplane. So the next day they did. He went up and took my dad in the B-29, which my dad was just thrilled to death. And he said, okay, Charlie, why don't you go ahead and take over and see how you do. Well, like, again, my dad was a natural pilot, so he was able to fly the airplane, no problems whatsoever. And, in fact, I think Paul Tibbetts refers to my dad as the crazy Boston Irishman that would fly a B-29 under the San Francisco Bridge if you asked him to.
Yeah.
And did. So
he did fly under the...
That's what he told me.
Under the bridge? You're not supposed to do that one. Okay.
No. But, you know, we're in the late 30s there.
Now, I'm surprised that I didn't know the 29 was around in 41, because the 29 didn't enter service till the end of the war.
Well, it was a secret. You didn't need to know.
No.
When did the B-29...
No.
When did the... They didn't...
I don't know the exact date, but the B-29 was the plane that dropped the atomic bomb.
No,
so it had to have been around.
But I'm just saying that when they were bombing the Japanese before that, and using
29s. Well, I'll get into that. Yeah. I'll get into that.
Right. But they didn't use the 29 in the European theater, ever.
No. This was a brand-new plane that was designed, built, but it was still a top-secret.
That's what I'm saying.
Aircraft.
In 41, it was still pretty secret.
Yes, absolutely. So at Eglin, my dad really liked the skills. Colonel Tibbetts liked the skills of my dad, and he said, I'm looking for some young pilots. I would really like to have you on my team. What do you think about that? And he said, I can't tell you what it is, but you're showing me the skills that what I'm looking for. And he said, well, I have orders to India at the end of the year, so there's no way I can do that. And Colonel Tibbetts said, well, we'll get those changed.
And India was a lousy place to fly. My wife's father flew in India. That was the hump. They flew over the Himalayas trying to supply the troops in Burma. And it was if that was what he had to fly, these little DC, whatever they were, DC-9s,
I don't have time for that. So Dad was really proud to have been thing, but he said, a colonel can't change my orders. And so he didn't really that much. Little did he know.
Yeah.
And the next day, his boss came down and said, your orders have been transferred, and now you're in working under Colonel Tibbetts. He said, wow, this guy must have a lot of...
Yeah,
who is
juice,
this guy?
Yeah.
But my dad also said that Paul Tibbetts was such a great leader that you would follow him anywhere. Mm. And the military has very few of what you call fine leaders, if you will. I'm not putting anybody down.
Right.
I'm just saying that to find somebody who's unique that you would want to follow is really a special thing. So they ended up flying off to Grand Island, Nebraska to do, quote, training. And there was a general at that time named General LeMay. And I'll just mention him briefly because Curtis LeMay. He comes into the story a little bit later. But for now, he was in charge of the Pacific Theater, and he wanted to learn about the B-29. So when a general comes into a base, usually there's a pomp and stance and a general's inspection all this other stuff. And when he landed, he said, get rid of all this stuff. I want to just learn how to fly the plane. So Tibbet said, well, I'm going to give you one of my best pilots, which really beefed up my dad, that Colonel Tibbets thought of my dad as one of his best pilots.
You know, Terry, I just want to go back and remind everybody. We're talking about a period. Your dad got his wings in 41.
Before the war.
Yeah, well,
in September of 41, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay, this is when?
This was shortly after that, maybe...
A couple of years?
No, not even a couple of years. Maybe a year.
I mean, that's phenomenal. It's a very... To Paul's point, I mean, it speaks to your volumes about your dad.
Right.
Well, like I say, he was a natural. So I don't know what... I don't even know what that is like. I've only met one other guy in my life that was a natural pilot.
I mean, and Percival. I mean, he pursued... The guy for right. He basically interviewed for a job that he didn't know he was interviewing for, but he knew he wanted to do something, right?
Well, yeah, and Dad's, you know, well, how he got that claim to fame is if anybody had an airplane that needed a maintenance check flight or needed to be delivered somewhere, call Chuck. Day or night, doesn't matter. He will
amazing.
Do it.
Now, two quick questions. How many other pilots were in this top secret group? And did
because it wasn't a big group.
He was looking. Tibbets was looking for a total of 9 pilots.
Okay.
Yeah. So
and they still didn't know what they were training for.
No one knew what they were training for, which was the very hard part. Okay.
Okay.
So while they were in, let me just touch on Tibbets a little. I mean LeMay a little bit. So he came in, and Tibbets said, I'm going to let my best pilot teach you. So, of course, my dad felt well about that. And Tibbets said, get rid of everybody. So he thought he'd want to take them out and flying. And he said, no, just take me to one in the hangar. So they go in the hangar. And for one day, they just spent the day in the cockpit. And LeMay said, what does this do? What does this do? What does this work? How does this circuit break? I mean, he just explained for 5 or 6 hours what every single button did. The next day, he said, okay, now we're going to go flying. He took the plane up, flew it flawlessly, got LeMay, and they went up in the morning. They took another flight in the afternoon, and he said, okay, that's all I need, and he left for Hawaii to lead the thing. So by that time, the orders were to fly down to Wendover. They were looking for a base that was out in the middle of nowhere to try to test these bombs. And now the bomb was Tibbets said, I want you to train the pilots. He says, well, how heavy is the bomb? He said, 10,000 pounds. Well, we'd never had a 10,000-pound bomb before.
Mm-hmm. Typical ones are like, what, 500 pounds or something?
Well, 500 is average still to this day. 1,000 would be big.
Right.
So they got down to Wendover, and they realized that they built concrete planes, concrete bombs, I should say, with the thing called Torpex in them, but they couldn't get them in the bomb. So, there was a code name, the Manhattan Project, and under that was a code name called Silverplate. Mm-hmm. And they were told, if you ever need anything, just use Silverplate. And so they realized that this particular B-29, the one that was stock, was not going to work. It had a gun turret in there or two. They had to get rid of it. It was too much weight. So Tibbets and my dad flew up to Seattle to meet with the Boeing executives and said, we need a B-29 that doesn't have this on it, doesn't have this on it, and we would like it to have reverse thrusters, and we would like it to have this, that, and the other thing. And the executives looked at them and they said, and who the hell do you think you are? You know,
we're
captain and a colonel.
We're Silverplate. Go look that
up. That's exactly what happened. And he said, well, we're here on a mission that's involves Silverplate. And they said, when do you need the planes? And they had 20 planes in Wendover within 30 days to spec. Pretty amazing.
Wow.
Pretty amazing. For the Boeing folks.
Wow.
Yeah. Amazing, amazing. Amazing what was going on in the world, in the United States that day for preparations for World War II. So so they're training and then doing this thing, and that's how my dad found out about the bomb. There were secret, I don't want to say secret service because they weren't around yet, but there were The I think it was the OSS.
OSS, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, there was an my dad told me there was an OSS agent for probably every single airman and officer that were on that base. So this was such top secret.
So they were
cooks, they were bartenders, they were maintenance people. You couldn't tell who was who, but they had their ears to the ground.
The predecessor
to
the CIA.
This predates the U.S. Air Force. I mean, there was no U.S.
Army Air Force. Army Air Force still.
Right.
So what happens was that my dad was at church one Sunday. He's coming out, and Colonel Tibbetts pulled up with a security officer, and they said, come on, we're going for a ride. And they drove off base, and they went into the desert about 10 miles, and they got out, and Paul Tibbetts said to my dad, he said, are you familiar with Einstein's theory of relativity? And he said,
No.
I read an article in Saturday Evening Post that had something about it years ago. But if I recall correctly, it was mass times speed squared, something like that. And he goes, well, you got the right concept. So Tibbetts picked up a handful of sand, and he said, we're building a bomb that can do this to a city and just turn the hand upside down. And the sand fell out. And my first reaction from my dad is, oh, my gosh, this would actually end the war.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, we couldn't say anything about it, but that was – and that was a big problem at the base because they couldn't tell the men what they were doing. But these guys were working round the clock and dropping these 10,000-pound bombs, but you couldn't say anything. And he said morale was very low and, you know, but that's the way it was.
So roughly how – I'm just trying to follow a timeline here. So the bomb gets dropped in 45. You're saying they start testing the pilots in, what, 42 or 3?
No, this is 40. No, we're in 44 now.
44, okay.
Okay. So, I mean, they didn't even have a crane to carry a 10,000-pound bomb. So they had to go to England to get a crane that could lift something that heavy. But, you know, all secret. No one knew anything. So they went – let me just turn the page here.
Yeah.
And he told them what was going to happen. They got the airplane to spec, and that was that. So the Trinity test, which a lot of people don't know about, but we're going to take this bomb, atomic in nature, but only 2,000 pounds, bring it up on a as high as they could on a, I don't know what you call it.
They built like a tower.
Tower.
Yeah,
what they built, a tower.
And then they stood back about a mile or so to watch and see what kind of things, if it was going to blow up.
And can I interrupt for a second?
Yeah.
Because that's down in New Mexico, the Trinity, first time they blew up an atomic bomb.
That's right. That was in Los Alamos.
And there were two theories out there. One was there was actually some fear that this would ignite a chain reaction around the Earth, that if they blew the bomb up, it would keep – the chain reaction wouldn't be contained and it would engulf the entire planet.
One of the scientists declared just that. Another scientist said that there's no way with the reverberations that we're going to live. So they didn't know if the world was going to blow up. They thought for sure they were going to blow up. But again, the concept was to end the war. At the time, we were losing 900 Marines a day through, you know, Guadalcanal all the way up to Iwo Jima to Okinawa to you name it. I mean, we were losing a lot of guys. So
that was relatively close to when they actually dropped the bomb, right?
Well, that was in July, and Truman had left to go to the Potsdam Conference in Germany, where he was going to meet up with Stalin and Churchill, and they were going to discuss the end of the war and how, you know, they decided that it was going to have to be an unconditional surrender with Japan, among other things. But
who said they would never surrender?
Right.
They were dying
at
Iwo Jima and stuff. They were dying to a man. They were fighting to the last breath.
Right. They were dug in tunnels. It was amazing.
And they had estimates that to invade the home island of Japan would cost a million or two
on each side.
On each side.
So anyway, they got word to Truman that the Trinity test was successful. That's when they got their orders, the 509th Composite, which is what it was called, to go down to Tinian Island, to fly down there.
This is in the South Pacific.
And the order was you have the go-ahead to drop anytime after August 1st. So Tibbetts was planning the missions and the primary targets were Hiroshima, Kokura, Nagasaki, and Nagita. And what we did is we dropped leaflets over all those cities and said, we're going to bomb these cities in the next week. Get out of the city. And the Japanese would not let the people leave the city. So
I had no idea that.
Oh yeah, we do that now in Afghanistan and in Iraq and Syria. I mean, that's the kind of nation we are. But anyway, so on the right wing was in the front plane was the Colonel Tibbetts in the first bomb. On the right wing was my dad and all the scientists in his plane, and they had all these measuring equipment that they were when Tibbetts bomb bay door open. My dad was going to open his bomb bay door, and they were going to drop all this measuring equipment to see what they could capture. Mm-hmm. On the left wing was the photo reconnaissance plane that, when you watch the History Channel mm-hmm. or PBS,
recorded
that
it.
Came from the left wing airplane. Mm-hmm. So and everything went like clockwork on the first one. I mean, it just, you know, Colonel Tibbetts, best as it was, naturally the plane goes.
Did they have fighter escort, or was it?
No,
they just flew in.
No, they flew.
Three planes.
It was a 7-plane mission. One plane, 3 were weather. One plane landed in Iwo Jima that we had already taken as in case anything broke down, they could go down and get a new airplane and come back up. But the rendezvous was, and the first one was over Iwo Jima, and at 30,000 feet, and they just headed straight in from there. So,
and by this time, the Japanese Air Force had pretty much been decimated, so there probably wasn't.
Yeah, and the first mission there was no
fighter attack.
Yeah. Okay,
and Terry, so I'm sorry. You also said that one of the requirements, that the city had to have a military installation of some sort, military value.
All the targets had to have military value. Number one, and they had never. They had to be cities that had never been bombed before.
Because we don't talk about it a lot, but there was a lot of bombing of Tokyo, for example, and a lot of
Doolittle fire raids. Because everything was made out of wood in Japan.
So they dropped these phosphorus bombs, and once they lit, they kept burning and burning and burning. They didn't just blow up.
People don't realize that the raids on Tokyo and other cities killed way more people than the atomic bomb.
That's right.
Because of the fires and everything. It was like 2 or 3 times more. But they don't know that.
But they didn't. It didn't.
That's why I asked the question.
Once,
yeah. I just wanted to have people to have that reference.
Yeah.
What? And let me interrupt one other thing.
Yeah,
the only criticism that's ever been leveled, I think, about this, and people, I'm sure your father was one. Tibbetts always said, "I have no regrets of doing this. End of the war. It's a horrible thing. Had to be done. And think of the lives we saved, not just the lives that were lost." But there was some speculation that maybe they should have dropped a test bomb to show, because nobody knew that such a bomb existed that was even conceivable. And Truman said, I didn't do it because if it had failed, that would have been equally bad propaganda-wise. They wouldn't have believed us then. So they felt they had to go ahead and drop the first bomb on a city, and if it didn't blow up, nobody knew it. And if it did blow up, it would...
It's a Monday morning quarterback.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Should we have dropped two? Wouldn't the one end up?
I don't know the truth to any of that story. I don't know. I personally don't know anything about that. I do know that when I was in college and I had to write a paper, and I'd never talked to my dad about this before, I thought, oh, man, I can just go downstairs and get the information and be
living
done with
history.
This thing.
Yeah.
And I asked him, I went downstairs, I said, Dad, you and I have never talked about this thing, and I got to write a paper, and is it possible that you can just sit and tell me some things? And he said, sure. But first, you need to go down to the library and go through the microfiche, no internet in those days, and find out what was going on a week before the war mm-hmm. and a week after. And I'm there, oh, come on, man, just give me the
dirt. I got to do more work.
Yeah.
So I had to go down to the library and get this microfiche, and it's like, oh, what a pain in the neck. But in doing that, I learned that at that time, it was the only thing to do. Again, we were losing 900 guys a day.
Yep.
There were two major invasions. I mean, we weren't going to stop. We were going to land on mainland Japan to the north, Operation Coronet, and to the south. I forget the name of the mission that was going to be. But they thought that the Japanese would lose at least 1 million people on those two land invasions. And we would lose at least 1 million men on the land invasion. They thought it would be way worse than D-Day.
Because these people would not surrender.
It was going to take 4 or 5
especially
waves.
Given the entrenchment that they encountered on the islands.
Well, yeah. And the suicidal nature of what they were doing.
Oh, yeah.
They were going to die for the emperor.
Yeah.
They couldn't have shame on the homeland. They would die to the last man.
Right. So aside from the war ending, I have people come up to me to this day that say, "Your dad saved my life."
Hmm.
You know, I was ready to go on the Coronet mission.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's just amazing. So my dad would always say, "Whose brothers, whose uncles, whose sons, whose nephews, whose grandfathers were saved because of the second atomic bomb?" So at the time, it was the only thing to do. And we only had 2 bombs, okay?
Yeah, that's
so we
the
had to
thing,
make
right.
them think that we had a whole slew of these things.
Right.
And we gave them the opportunity to surrender after the first one, and they wouldn't take it.
Mm-hmm.
So when they came back and landed and they debriefed, later that night, Colonel Paul Tibbetts came up to my dad and he said, "Charlie, if we need to do the second mission, I want you to run the second mission." And my dad said, same tactics, meaning 3 planes at 30,000 feet, 3 B-29s, and he said, same tactics. And my dad said in the back of his mind, he said, "Don't you think the Japanese are going to be a little bit smarter this time?"
They're going to be ready.
But what he didn't tell Tibbetts was Tibbetts had gone to MIT to find out the mechanics of the Japanese Zero, and if they had passed at a certain speed and made a turn, could they have gotten... But he never mentioned that to my dad.
Mm.
That wasn't part of the thing. Mm. He just said, "Yeah, same tactics." And, of course, I learned about that later in life, but
now, keep in mind, this is a different bomb, too. This was a...
Yeah, this was a bomb that was going to... It had to be fused from takeoff, which was one big problem because it was the plutonium bomb, and this bomb was going to detonate 1,500 feet above whatever the target,
right.
whatever it was they were going to hit.
So they weren't sure the second bomb was going to even work.
They hadn't.
So even though it was the same tactic, it wasn't the same mission.
Yeah, it
because
was
of the
totally
nature
different
of the
bomb,
device.
Much bigger bomb. Plutonium bomb.
Actually, that was the bomb that they later on produced more of. It wasn't Little Boy. It was actually Fat Man.
And that's what we're afraid the North Koreans have claimed that they've now exploded.
I think that's the one they dropped on Bikini
Atoll.
Well, they've done a plutonium since then.
Yeah.
Now, did you know? I had to look it up because I was curious. Did you know where the names come from?
Fat Boy and Little Man. No.
Yeah. Do you know it, Terry?
I don't know.
I knew it
you
one time, but
on
I don't
that.
Remember.
Okay, I'm not claiming that I knew this.
No.
I looked it up, right? Which is cool. Okay, a Little Boy comes from Thin Man, from the book by what's his name,
Dashiell Hammett.
Right. Yeah, and Fat Man comes from the Maltese Falcon.
Oh, the
oh,
Fat
really?
Man, Sidney Greenstreet.
Sidney Greenstreet.
Yeah,
okay.
The Fat Man and the Little Boy.
So the Little Boy changed
things. Now, I have to ask the question that I'm sure your dad has been asked, but not about whether or not it was just – we've covered that, and I agree with you. I think most people, the historians, have come down as awful as it was. Not if you're in the poor Japanese that got killed that day, but it saved millions of lives at the cost of 100,000 lives. A horrible calculation, but it was taken, and it did end the war. Now, my question is, when your dad saw this blow up – what did he think? Because nobody, other than the people at Trinity, had ever seen this or could imagine it. And I'll preface it by saying this part. I actually know something about the Trinity explosion. They put it on the top of a tower.
And dropped it.
No, they set it on the top of a tower. And they put it on a steel concrete tower so they could see later on what kind of damage it would do. And after the bomb went off, the tower was gone. Mm-hmm. And they all looked at each other and went, "Oh, shoot." These people who were supposed to know didn't know that the tower would evaporate. They didn't really quite understand what they were unleashing at that moment. So now your dad, this guy from Boston, who a couple years earlier just learned to fly, is going to drop something that no human being has ever seen before. And they say when it went off, I mean, there was a shock wave and there was a heat blast and all this stuff. What recount that?
Like I said, my dad was on the first one, so they had. The only way that they had they couldn't go to the Air Force. They had never dropped a bomb this big.
No,
they didn't have ballistics tables to figure out how to do it.
they couldn't talk to anybody about it.
The Air Force and ask them how to do it. So they calculated it themselves. They figured it out themselves
with a slide ruler, probably.
I don't know, but it, as it turned out, They learned that if they did a 30-degree angle of bank and turned 155 degrees down, that that would give them the greatest. They had it to be 12 miles away, nautical miles. So that would have given them 12 nautical miles, actually 13, to be that distance
to
from
avoid
the,
blast. It had such a blast
but
to it.
My dad said, he said it was, so he's on the first one, so he got to see it. He says, I saw the concentric circles. It was every color in the world. He said it was, you know, brighter than any rainbow that you could ever see. And he said, and our plane started to shake, and my bombardier was saying, hey, we're taking flak, because the plane was shaking up and down
like
and everything else.
Flying.
And he says, you know, we're getting hit. And he said, well, this guy must know, because he was in Germany, and he got shot down 12 times. So he must know what he's talking about. But my dad said, the plane was still flying. Mm-hmm. So I just held on, and I kept flying. And then after a while, I realized, oh, this is... We're not getting hit. This is actually repercussions from the bomb.
The shockwave.
So he said, okay, so now that I know what it is, all I have to do is just get us out of this. So he knew the second time what to expect.
But he must have had an aw shoot moment when they looked at it. Knowing what it's going to do, still, when you see it go off that close and feel it and everything.
So Paul, I have no idea.
Paul, I know you're probably going to run over the hour.
You've
already made the decision, right?
Yes.
Okay, so do you want to take the break and then come back?
Okay. All right. We'll take a break and come back. Fascinating firsthand account of a moment in time that we are remembering today here this week.
Yeah, we'll go over.
That's all right.
Yeah.
Imagine what it would feel like to lose everything. Your job, your home, your family, your dignity. This has happened to thousands of the men, women, veterans, and young adults we serve at Working Wardrobes. What do we do to help? We provide career development services, life skills workshops, job skills training. We provide the perfect interview outfit, and we get clients placed in jobs. Call Working Wardrobes, 714-210-2460. Donate, volunteer, invest, hire.
If you are like the majority of Americans, you want to continue living in a familiar environment throughout your maturing years. In fact, according to many surveys, 82% of homeowners overwhelmingly prefer to age in place, which means living in their current homes safely, independently, and comfortably, regardless of age or ability level. With over 30 years of combined experience in residential, commercial, hospitality, and destination resorts fields, Your Home for a Lifetime is a company dedicated to empowering you to maintain your quality of life and independence by helping you make your house your home for a lifetime. Do you want to reorganize or remodel your home? Do you want to add a full bathroom and possibly a bedroom on the main floor? Are you looking to make your kitchen more functional? Is an aging parent moving in, or your child is moving out, or even moving back in? Call Your Home for a Lifetime at 949-492-1872 or check them out on the web at yourhomeforalifetime.com and find out how they can help you make your house your home for a lifetime.
All right, strap in. We're in for a bumpy ride.
So that's where we left off. This is really fascinating, and it really reinforces why the format of the way that the show has organically evolved really leads to interesting stuff. Where if you're just joining us, I want to reintroduce my guest for the hour plus we're going to go over this today is retired Captain U.S. Marine Corps Terry Sweeney, who's the son of
Major General.
Right? Retired Major General Charles Sweeney. Who is the only man who flew both missions over Japan that were the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima, and then the second one, he actually flew the lead plane and dropped the bomb on Nagasaki.
So Tibbetts didn't go on the second mission? I didn't know that.
No.
Well, it was in good hands with Chuck, right?
I got to ask you a couple little quick questions here that are just,
sure,
I'm thinking, is this is a rare opportunity to talk to somebody. I've never known anybody.
And Paul is all giddy, by the way, because his dad was a bomber pilot in the Second World War.
Yeah.
Well, and
a lot of guys.
And I'll just say one weird thing, that my dad finished his missions in 1944, I think it was, after D-Day.
Yeah.
And can't go home. War's still going on.
Yeah.
And they said, well, you want to re-up? Here we go. We can fly another 30-some missions. And he said, hell no. And so they said, well, you only got one choice. That's to go to Japan. And work continues there. And he was on his way there and got drunk at a bar and met a colonel who said, you don't want to go to Japan. He said, here, I need somebody to run this rest home here for flyers. And my dad said, yeah, okay, fine, whatever you want. And the next morning got assigned to run a rest home. And that's but for that drunken night at a pub, he would have been in
Japan. So given the nature of what this show is supposed to be, loosely, which is about seniors and whatever, right? That's even funnier.
Yeah. That's the truth.
Your dad actually predicted the show and your involvement in the seniors.
He did. All these years. He gave birth to me just so for this moment to happen. All right, so here's my question. How did two questions. One is about you. You knew your dad had this historical connection, but he didn't talk about it? Did the kids not talk about it? Did your dad not recount this story a million
or
times?
Or did he talk about it?
No, that generation never talked about it.
Because my dad didn't talk about it until he got old. And that, then
same. And my dad did not want to write the book. One of my sisters convinced him to do it for historical purposes.
Yeah.
He didn't want to recall it at all. And, you know, my mom said that he had nightmares and you know, he did imbibe a lot. And so I'm sure, you know, he had no regrets.
He believed in the mission. Right.
He believed in the mission. And he said, and besides, Terry, he says it was an order.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in the military and you get an order, it's not like you can say, well, I don't think that's a good idea.
Right.
You follow orders.
And so I'll tell you my dad's quick story, which I told you before. First mission, he goes over in Germany. This is earlier part of the war. No fighter cover. Goes up. 50% of the planes get shot down. Mm. And I said to my dad years later, I got you. How they got you to go the first time. How'd they get you to go the second time?
What did he say?
He said, it was an order.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Same thing.
So we left off, Terry, before the break about the reverberations from the impact bomb.
I'm going to
back
a little
up. Go ahead.
And just tell you. So my dad gets the go-ahead from Tibbetts to go ahead and they're going to he's going to drop the second bomb.
Okay.
So at 2 a.m., they go down a pre-flight, and problem number one, the instrument that they had in my dad's plane, which was called the Great Artiste, were still in the plane. The crew had put the bomb on the wrong plane. They put it on a guy named Ernie Bach's plane. So, and the crew chief, as they're pre-flighting, says, oh, yeah, we have 600 gallons of fuel that won't transfer. So that was a little bit scary, and my dad looked up at Tibbetts, who was there, and he said, well, Colonel, what do you think? And Colonel Paul Tibbetts looked at my dad, and he said, Chuck, it's your mission.
You decide.
Mm.
He was 25 years old, and he said, we go.
So the bomb was on the wrong plane.
The bomb was on the wrong plane. The fuel wasn't enough. The fuse had to be live on takeoff. Never happened in any other bombing mission ever. And
yeah, because they used to arm them in the air.
And that night, I mean, B-29s were crashing left and right, and three had crashed that night before.
So Terry, your dad, at the age of 25, is making a decision to ride a plane with a live bomb on takeoff.
An atomic bomb.
On takeoff.
Oh, it gets better. Gets better.
In a plane that has crashed because it's somewhat...
No, this plane didn't
Well,
crash.
No, but I mean, the
B-29s were crashing all the time.
Planes were crashing all the time. With not enough fuel.
That's about right.
Why am I visualizing
the thing about the fuel
Dr. Strange's love?
No.
It's the greatest generation. They just go.
The thing about the fuel was, is they had landed when they came back on Tinian, the first one, they had plenty of fuel. So they thought, okay, a 600-gallon transfer isn't going to be a problem.
Hmm.
It turned out to be a major problem, and I'll get into it.
Okay, go ahead.
So they take off and
amazing.
In the boxcar, and they go to rendezvous, three planes, and one of the rendezvous planes doesn't show up.
and explain why, because that's...
Well, he first of all, this guy hadn't been really involved in the mission at all, and he wanted to have this claim of fame that I was involved in the atomic mission, and he was going to be the photo guy, so... You know, Tibbetts said, all right, you know, let him go for posterity's sake because he's harmless anyway. Well, he went to 39,000 feet instead of 30,000. Okay? And they had changed the island because Iwo Jima was having a typhoon that was flying in, so they had to go to another island to rendezvous. So he completely missed the boat. So problem number three, they were radio silence the entire time. This guy breaks radio silence and says, you know, you can't find my dad. And they're circling and circling, waiting, you know, wasting fuel. He said, did Sweeney abort? Well, that translation came back to Tinian as Sweeney aborted.
Hmm.
So the first thing that went through their minds is, well, we don't need these search and rescue airplanes, because what the Air Force does is they put search and rescue C-130s or whatever they were at that time
PBYs
out over the water.
Or
yeah, to, you know, if the plane crashes, sure, to be able to get them within a 30-minute period.
Right.
So they said, okay, well, we don't need search and rescue anymore. Pull those guys back. Secondly, what was I going to say?
I have never heard any of this, and I'd read
a lot about it. It is in the book.
They used to have an acronym in World War II called FUBAR. You know what FUBAR stands for?
I sure do, but you can't say it on the air.
We'll say fouled up. Fouled up beyond all repair.
Yeah. So they're also thinking, well, what's Sweeney going to do with the bomb? Is he going to drop it in the ocean? Is he going to try to land back here with a live atomic bomb? What's he going to do? But they didn't want to talk over the radio, so they didn't know. So there's a lot of fear going on back at Tinian with all the top brass and everything. And then on the leg from the rendezvous point, the fuse goes live. Okay? So, I mean, it had to be on, but not live. And that from then they had 50 seconds to decide what to do. So now they have an atomic bomb that's live that shouldn't be live. They have two crews, and the fuel is getting low. The primary target is Kokora, and the weather report said that Kokora was fine. However, because of the bombing raids that happened in a city close by to it, Iwana, the winds had changed, and now we're blocking Kokora, and the orders were to drop visually. So
primary target unavailable.
Right. So they made a pass.
How would you like to be the people that lived in that town and found out later there was actually
a term that came out of that, and I'll find it while Terry's talking, but there's a term that came out of that that basically refers to luck. Like, what's the name of the town?
Kokora.
Like something like Kokora luck or something came out of that for that.
But anyway, they made a pass, and at 30,000 feet, nothing. They went up to 31,000 feet, and that's when the Japanese Zeros started coming up and shooting at them. So they, even though they knew the planes couldn't hit them from that altitude, the Japs couldn't fly that high, they made a third pass at 32,000 feet, and the engineer is saying, we don't have fuel to get back into the base now. I mean, we can't be making these continuous runs.
Right.
So my dad said, okay, secondary target, excuse me, is Nagasaki. So they headed over to Nagasaki, and I think the Zeros had to go refuel or whatever, so they had a pretty good shot, and the weather was socked over at Nagasaki. And so they said, well, we don't have enough fuel for one pass now. And he said, well, we're going to make one. And they made the pass, they couldn't see anything, so they went around, circled around. And as they're making the second pass, the bombardier, who actually drops the bomb, said, I've got it. And at that time, you turn the plane over to the bombardier,
right,
who actually has a steering wheel, and he drove it in, and they dropped the bomb. And then, of course, they went into that slant range turn. And
fewer people, some less people died in Nagasaki because it was very hilly.
But they hit right in between two Mitsubishi factories. I mean, it couldn't have been a better hit from a strategic standpoint.
Mm.
And so the less people died because it was a little bit over the water, but at the same time we demolished those two factories, which were primary factories at that time.
And within days, the emperor came on and spoke to his people for the first time ever. They had never heard their own emperor's voice because at that time they thought he was a semi-deity, and he had never spoken. They'd never heard his voice before, and he came on the radio and said, that's it.
Yeah. So let me get the plane back to the...
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, okay.
So anyway, they're coming back. They don't have the fuel left, and things start, you know, the hydraulic fluid pumps start working. The oil light comes on. You know, all these these different things. So he says, well, there's no way we can get back to Tinian. There's absolutely no way. What's the closest field? And they said, Okinawa. So Tibbetts had taught my dad what they call a step program. It's like going down your hill in car in neutral and then climbing back up. Well, you can do that in the air. And Colonel Tibbetts had taught my dad how to do this with, like, it's a dolphin type thing, if you will, to do a step up and then glide. And but by now, the radios had broken, everything had spoken. So when you're coming into a military base, you're looking, the tower will show a green light, revolving green light, or revolving red light, which means the field is closed. You cannot land here for whatever reason. Maybe there's a plane on the runway that's crashed or whatever. And then there's a split green light. And so they're coming in, and three engines have quit of four engines. My dad said, throw out all the flares, everything. They're rocking their wings, trying to get attention to the tower. Basic ops are going on. This plane's, you know, taking off and landing, and they don't see them. And they said, we had to come in hot and heavy because there's no other way we can get this thing in there. And finally, the tower saw the plane and got everything out of the way, gave them the green light, and they came down and landed and rolled off the runway with 3 gallons of gas.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
My dad said to this crew, don't say anything to anybody because they were in Okinawa and they weren't supposed to know
what
had happened, and they didn't know.
Here's my second question I was going to ask earlier, now it's even better. So why did this not propel your father into the same fame it did for fame or infamy, depending on whether people thought it was a good idea or a bad idea? I did not know who flew the second mission.
Okay.
I did not. The first mission we all know, and they know the name of the plane, the Enola Gay, and Colonel Tibbetts, if you read anything about history, all that. The rest of the people on all these missions didn't seem to get it. Was it just because it was the second, and the second's never as big as the first? Or was it an attempt to keep it quiet or something? I never heard any of the story. I never heard any of the problem that went on.
I really don't know, to be honest with you. I just know that, you know, it was Paul Tibbetts' mission from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And he executed the plan flawlessly.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that things went wrong, and in fact, Tom Hanks bought the rights to the book because it was kind of like an Apollo 13 thing, which we're still hoping. And Tom, if you're listening.
Perfect. Tom, come on on. Come
you know,
on.
He likes World War II stories, and this was kind of an Apollo 13 type thing.
Right.
So anything for HBO even would be great. But from what I've heard is they can't find a suitable ending to a movie like this that everybody would be pleased with. Mm. But I don't know how true that is. But Tom, if you're out there listening, would love to have a movie.
That's amazing, right? Trying to put a nice little ribbon on something that is that in itself is a phenomenal story without needing that.
Because I think the story has to be told. You know, we do have to keep history alive so people know.
Terry, you mentioned something here. I'm just going to explore this for a minute with you. Okay, so the plane that didn't make it, the one that was at 9,000 feet higher than where it's supposed to be.
Yes.
Was that the observation plane?
Yes, that was the plane that would have taken the pictures on the left.
So I don't know. Is there less photographic documentation on the Nagasaki?
There's none on the second one.
So that could also have a lot to do with the fact that what played out was the Enola Gay over Hiroshima.
Absolutely.
That's the one you hear about, read about.
It's amazing how history just kind of unfolds in ways that you can.
Yeah, if we have movies of it, we can talk about it. But if we don't have proof,
as Paul Harvey used to say, and now there's the rest of the story.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is the rest of the story.
This is the rest of the story. Thank you, Terry, for giving it to us.
So now the next one. I hope this isn't a difficult question for you. I'm not trying to be offensive.
There is no
here,
difficult question.
But obviously, we're remembering this now. What's the anniversary?
71 years.
Yeah. And the current Prime Minister to Japan has invited people to come back just to remind people why we never want to drop bombs again, and you know, just remember this moment in time. This is really the only two times that the atomic bomb was ever used in war, and we did it, and we don't like to think of that, you know.
Yes.
But it, all the rationalizations and the reasons that it had to be done, it was done, and people who did it said, "I can't change that." There was a reason for it. We did it.
Yeah.
It's sort of like the POWs, McCain and others, going back to visit Vietnam at some point afterwards. Did your dad ever want to go there again, or was he ever invited to come back to any of these things?
My dad was in Nagasaki 3 days after he dropped the bomb.
Oh, my God. Wasn't he subjected to radiation and everything?
Well, I'm sure he was. I don't know for sure, but they went in to see the devastation. They went to Hiroshima first, and then they went down to Nagasaki. And they were actually staying. They stayed the night in Nagasaki, and that's when my dad learned about the Jesuit missionary down there.
Talk about that.
Yeah, talk about that. Well, let me get this. Sure. But the funny part was, he says they went into the hotel, and he said, I didn't know if I should put my name down on the register at the front desk. And he said, but Paul Tibbetts was in front of me, and he wrote down Paul Tibbetts, commander, blah blah blah. And he says, well, if it's good enough for him, it's good enough for me. So he wrote his name, but. Yeah, this is something that my dad never told us about, but being Catholic and then finding out that there was a Catholic missionary down there were actually some of the original guys, Paul Meinke and his companions, were actually crucified upside down in Nagasaki.
He learned about the martyrs of the church.
And so he set up a fund for that and never told any of his children. We didn't find out about it until he died.
Wow. Because, just to finish the story, if you've ever seen the miniseries Shogun a long time ago, the Jesuits came in the 1500s or 1600s, I think, when the feudal system was still in place, and really made great efforts to convert to Catholicism, to Christianity. Correct. I don't know how successful or not they were, but they became very influential.
Oh, the Jesuits?
The Jesuit order in Japan.
My father went to a Jesuit university in Beirut. I mean, they got far and wide.
There was a big influence. And you're saying that one of the early places they set up schools and missions was in Nagasaki, and the Americans didn't realize there was such a large... I don't know, that would have changed their calculation at all.
I don't think
But that there were... This wasn't just the Japanese enemy that we were fighting. There were some... There were a lot of them.
Well, I don't know if they were American. There were American priests, but there was obviously a large civilian population and obviously a large Catholic population.
Right.
So yeah, no, it wasn't just Japanese that died.
So did he ever go back? And he was there to go days because, again, this did end the war. They ended within, 24 hours or 48 hours or something like that?
It ended very shortly after that. But my dad said, at the time, as we talked about earlier, it was the only thing to do. Mm-hmm. And his next sentence is, and I hope we never have to do it again.
Exactly. But it had to be difficult. It would have to be your mind to go down and see what you did. You pulled the trigger.
Yeah.
This happened.
Yeah.
And to see that kind of devastation days after and pain and suffering.
I can't imagine.
I can't either.
But he did get to see it. So he did get to see what.
And again, this is a silly question. Somebody tweeted in. Did they get any awards for this?
He has the Air Force Flying Cross and a couple of other.
But I wonder why there was not a Medal of Honor awarded or any of that kind of stuff. This is one of those once. Maybe they didn't think it was the same danger or something, but it's certainly bravery of the highest order.
Silver Star, I think, too. Right?
Yeah, Silver Star. He did get the Silver Star. But it was more the war is over.
Yeah, that's
and
really...
And the boys are coming home. They made the ticker tape parades in New York.
900 people dying a day.
A day.
And no land invasion on mainland. It was like a million estimated death on both sides, so it wasn't just the Allied forces. It was also Japanese.
The Japanese were committed to fight.
I will say this. I did look it up, right? And there's a reference of a 14-year-old kid at the time who literally saw the plane fly over Kakura.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and there is supposedly in Japan still referred to as the luck of Kakura in reference to that time when some bad weather basically saved lives of tens of thousands of people there.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
So here's a 14-year-old kid that's watching this thing over because they dropped that bomb around noon.
No, it was earlier than that. They took off. Hiroshima was at about 8:15 a.m. because of the delays at the rendezvous point. Theirs was more in the 10 o'clock range.
Okay, so this was early morning.
This
kid was basically out watering or something. Yeah. Sees a plane go over, and he's in Kakura, and then sees a flash in Nagasaki. Mm-hmm. So, to your dad's point, it had to be done, and hope to God they know.
Hopefully it's never happened.
Now, the other part of the story is, after we did this, the war has been changed. We've never had a major war. We've had lots of minor, I say minor war. We haven't had a world war again, because the theory is with atomic weapons unleashed, this is the end of mankind now here. And we came close to it in the 50s and 60s a couple of times, the Cuban Missile Crisis and some other things where we almost unleashed these things at each other here. But and there's worry again that groups will get atomic bombs and drop them, not nation states anymore, but crazy groups out there that want to do this. It not only ended the war, it changed the world forever.
Including an arms race.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Let's just not forget that, yes. Right? I looked it up. It was like 120 Fat Man units were produced between 1947 and 1949.
Yeah.
So, yes, we saw devastation in a scale that we have never seen before, and yet at the same time, that didn't just go away, and that was the only time we built it. It didn't end the idea of it being in combat and using such weapons. And that's why, I mean, you guys basically were of an age, you lived in a generation where
duck and cover.
The reality was duck and cover, right?
Yeah, the fallout shelters.
Fallout shelters.
Yeah.
So what, I mean, I told you before when we started this, Terry, you know, I want to know, here's your dad. This is a huge, incredibly historic, monumental, any way you want to look at it, moment, right?
Yes.
And you're right in the middle of it. I mean,
well, I wasn't born yet.
Well, not you, but your dad was right in the middle of it. In fact, you could almost, you know, I can only imagine what went through his head. I actually chased Tibbetts to the point where I basically got myself on this thing. Now I find myself at this threshold of history that's forever recorded.
Right.
What happens with your dad after?
Okay, so the military was obviously letting people go left and right. I mean, we downsized tremendously.
My dad couldn't wait to get out.
Yeah. Well, what my dad did is the Air Force had started, I think it was in 1945, and what he did is he joined the Air National Guard in Massachusetts.
Okay.
And here's really where the other story comes in, is he was senior then. He was a one-star general, and he became good friends with John F. Kennedy, who was a senator at that time in Massachusetts.
Wow. Talk about moment. This is like, what's that movie, Zelig, or where you keep intersecting people
go
in history. Yeah.
Well, anyway, Logan was, the Air National Guard, which is now down on Cape Cod at Otis Air Force Base, but at the time was at Logan Air Force Base. So in those days, in the 50s, Senator Kennedy would call over to my dad and say, Charlie, do you have any planes going down to Washington, D.C.? I have a vote that I have to do at 3 o'clock today. And he said, well, what time would you need to be there? And he said, well, you know, 2:15, if you have something going down. And my dad would say, well, let me look on the board and see what we have going. And there's nothing on the board.
Right.
And he says, well, I've got something going at about 1 o'clock, if that would help you. Great, perfect. You know, and he would fly Kennedy down there, wait for him to vote, and then fly him back.
That's hilarious.
And then in return, Kennedy would say, hey, Charlie, Air Force is playing Notre Dame this weekend, and we can't figure out how to get the band from the Air Force Academy over to Notre Dame. I'll take care of it for you, sir. And we would get to go on football junkets.
That's amazing.
And fast forward. Kennedy now becomes president.
Yeah.
Okay. You talked a little bit about the Berlin, the Cuban Missile Crisis,
right.
But the Berlin Crisis.
Right.
We had
the
just come out. This is where my dad's claim to fame in his mind was. Much harder mission than the atomic bomb. He said we had the first jet, if you will, the F-86, and we had about 100 of them, maybe 200. And LeMay is now in charge of the European theater. He's a 3-star general. He's over in Germany. And John Kennedy calls my dad and says, you know,
John Kennedy calls my dad. I just, I've never known anybody
well,
who could
it's
say.
Look, at Massachusetts, Irish.
Right. Yeah, come
right. Okay. Plus, when Kennedy was president, he would fly into Otis Air Force Base where my dad was the commander.
Right.
Because he would be going down to Hyannisport.
But you understand, as an Irish Catholic kid, I've never heard the words, and when John Kennedy called my dad.
Oh, yeah. No. Or when my dad called him.
Yeah, right.
Oh, no. Yeah, no, it was surreal stuff.
Yeah, and, very surreal.
He would come in, and my dad would take us on Air Force One, and, Jackie smoked L&M cigarettes, so they made they made cigarettes with the presidential seal on them and then sealed them.
Oh, funny.
So we would steal them off the plane and everything else we could get,
So what happened in Berlin?
So Kennedy says to my dad, he says, what do I do? I don't know what the hell to do. And he says, listen.
Well, let's set it up because the Russians had blockaded it off and we're going to starve us out of there.
He said, my dad said, we need to get these F-86s over to Europe ASAP. I mean, with no time to spare. And he said, well, how do I do it? He said, just write the order and I'll take care of it. So he has McNamara write the order. This is a beautiful story. So he said they didn't have air refueling at that time. So they had to fly up through Iceland and Greenland and then Scotland and then back down. And they were going to go to France, Fallsburg, France, which they did. And they did it. My dad accomplished that. Now, you got to remember, there were planes coming out of Texas, planes coming out of Nebraska, planes coming out of Oklahoma, planes coming out of New Hampshire. I mean, just all over the place. It was the largest airlift, if you want to call it that, of guard airplanes ever in the history of the Air National Guard. He gets them all there in 3 days. Every single F-86 that we have in 3 days.
And tell the number again. How many were there?
I think it was 200. I don't know exactly, but I want to say, let's say 150.
In 3 days.
In 3 days. Okay. He said, Terry, we had bulldozers on the runways on each place in case some guy came in and didn't have enough
fuel. Push him out of the way.
Push him out of the way because we didn't know when the next guy was coming in. And then he said to me, and of course, at the Oak Club that night, I had to be the last guy to leave to make sure everybody got home okay.
Yeah.
But he says, the biggest claim to fame, he says, so here we are in Fallsburg, France, and there's nothing here. I mean, nothing. He said, so I called the White House, and I said, I got McNamara, and I said, listen, we're here. Tell the president we're here. And he says, you can't be there that fast. He goes, no, we're here. But there's nothing here. I mean, I need chow halls. I need barracks. I need hangars for the plane. I need, He said, the very next day, I saw the power of the United States. He said there were buses, trains, Army Corps of Engineers. He said, I don't know where they came from. I have no idea, Terry. He says, but they just showed up, and they built us a base in a week. This was the most amazing thing.
Built us a base in a week.
I've seen in my life. So now, LeMay.
Because he picked up the phone and called.
Yeah. Well,
John.
No. So anyway, LeMay is now over in Germany with the regular Air Force.
Yeah.
He gets wind that there's some guard guy over in France with all the fighters, all the F-86s. Well, who the hell gave that order? And he's all pissed off. And of course, my dad is hearing the whole thing. So I didn't tell you one thing. When my dad landed in Okinawa, LeMay was there, and he said, Terry, I walked into his office, and he was smoking a cigar, and he never looked up at me, and he said, you missed your primary target, didn't you? And he said,
sort of.
It was, how do you answer that question? Because they didn't really miss it. It was fogged in. Their orders were to drop visually, so they went to so I just said, yes, sir. And he said, LeMay, didn't lift up his head. He says, get out of my office, and started smoking on a cigar.
The man just dropped the bomb that ended the war.
The war was still going on.
Yeah, but fine.
So, but he was telling me this right before I went into the Air Force.
Classic,
before I went into the Marines.
That's classic LeMay.
I got to finish the story. So he goes out in the hallway, and Doolittle is out there.
Another guy.
3-star general. And he says, hey, I just heard what happened. Let me buy you a drink. And he said, the moral of the story is, Terry, is that when you go into the Marines, you're always going to find somebody who's a jerk, who's going to be your boss. He's going to be a jerk. But there'll always be a guy above him that's a good guy.
Okay? Amen.
And it was true. That was in my 11 years in the Marine Corps, that was absolutely
again,
true.
As an amateur history buff, particularly World War II, you've rattled off a whole slew of names that are just
So let me finish this. So now LeMay, when fast forward, we're in 62.
Who the heck has these?
62.
Jets.
And, so he says, get me over to France right away. So they get a plane ready, and he gets wind that the general's coming. So he has everything all set up, general's inspection, the whole nine yards. And he says, and I had the cigars that LeMay smoked. And he said, so LeMay comes in, he's all piss and vinegar, and, you know, who gave you the order to do this? And he said, the commander-in-chief, sir. And he said, he pulled out a cigar, and it was the ones that LeMay smoked, yeah. And he lit it up. And he said, and where the hell did you get that? And he said, well, sir, when the president puts me in charge of something, I leave no detail to tell.
Oh, wow.
Little all right, digs. Almost end of the story.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, he was just
I've never known anybody knew face. Curtis LeMay. This guy's
back
legendary.
And I got to meet him.
How many years later?
Okay, let me finish this.
Okay.
I got one.
When he's done,
so
I'll tell you
Curtis LeMay
story.
My father's claim to fame, and I'll shut up. My father's claim to fame. Now, as if the bomb wasn't, as if getting these planes wasn't. They're guard guys. And back in the United States, there's all this gruff from the wives. And why do the guard guys have to be there? And why can't we just have regular, including my mother, because they were over there for a while. And so Kennedy is going to come on TV that night and say, okay, we're going to pull back the guards and reserves and we're going to let the regular Air Force take over. Well, what they were doing is they were going to Ireland on weekend to pubs and down to Italy for plays and over to Switzerland and Austria. And they were having a ball.
European trip.
Yeah, and they're dogfighting with the Canadians and the Europeans. And, you know,
the name was
they're
Sweeney,
having
right?
yeah. a yeah, they're having a ball. Okay,
Irishman knows how to.
Yeah, they do indeed. God bless them. So anyway, he says he gets wind that the president is going to get on TV that night and. You say, okay, we're going to pull back these guys. My dad calls the White House, and he says, I've got to talk to the president. He gets through to the president, and he says, Jack, I got to tell you something.
Jack.
We're fine. He says, nobody over here is complaining. The morale is extremely high, and we're good for another 3 to 6 months if you want us to stay. Really, there's no issue
we'll
here.
We'll say if you want, yeah.
He said the president went on TV that night and changed his speech and said, we're going to keep him there for another 6 months.
Because of your dad.
And he said, tell me anybody you know that can get the president to change his speech.
Wow.
End of story.
End of story.
Well done.
I gotta find the applause.
Well done. Well done.
That's not written.
Well done. There you go. No, that's probably not written. That's amazing. Okay, so tell your LeMay story, Paul.
Oh.
All right, so Curtis LeMay is a famous figure. I think he was in charge of the European theater, was
he? Was. Yeah. Well, yes.
And
the Pacific.
Always had a big cigar.
Always.
So much later on, I'm a hippie, protesting, unhappy about the Vietnam War.
Same.
And who is still around is Curtis LeMay.
Yeah.
And Curtis LeMay is the man that went down in history and said, the quote still says, I don't know if it's apocryphal or if he really said it, let's bomb them back into the Stone Age.
Yes.
And he's the only guy that advocated dropping the atomic bomb again in Vietnam.
Yes.
And the French had asked us to do this, and he said, sure, what the hell? We got them. We'll use them.
I thought I heard somebody currently running for president say that.
And then Curtis LeMay did run with George Wallace. Wasn't he his vice president? I think he was on the American Independent Party.
Right.
Yeah, with George Wallace, 1968.
So Curtis LeMay is not just famous in World War II, but became even more infamous during the 60s as the most proponent of let's just bomb the hell. We got this bomb. Let's use it.
Okay, so in the early 80s, I'm working as a stockbroker. I get out of the Marine Corps, and I'm working in Laguna Beach as a stockbroker. And one of my clients is a history buff like you guys.
Right.
And he says, did you know that Curtis LeMay lives in Newport Beach?
Oh, you're kidding.
And I said, no. He said, if I call him and ask him if we can come over, would you go with me? I said, of course I would. Well, we went up there. He allowed us to come to his house.
Oh, my goodness.
We sat in his living room. And we just let him talk, and I got a history lesson of probably 4 hours. Right, I never mentioned my dad or anything, and I don't think he remembered my dad.
But
oh, your dad snubbed him.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I mean that was
who? Yeah,
he told me stories about what was going on in China prior to this, and things that were going on in Europe. It was the most well, other than hearing my dad's stories. It was just so beautiful.
Okay, so I want to just say something. Okay, people may who are listening to this going, okay, why are you guys
five
going
more
over?
Minutes for Griffin.
Okay, why are you guys okay. going over?
Because I have one story.
Yeah, no, and his dad did a bunch of other stuff after that
sure.
I want to touch on. But here's the thing, right? People say, well, what is this show about? Okay, now
I don't know, but it's fascinating.
No, I'll tell you what it's about. We say it's a life's journey.
Yes.
It's a journey of aging, right?
Right.
Now some people go, well, that's you person getting older. No, it's not that. I'm also president of the San Clemente Historical Society, and there's such a thing as in my mind that's called living history.
Yes.
Living it and actually doing it, all right, and remembering it. And it's things like this that we don't document. So for whatever little teeny tiny part of history that this show now being recorded on YouTube and is also now we have a video and audio
right.
of Terry sitting here talking about his dad.
Amazing
and touching
stories.
On all these people, right? Mm-hmm. That becomes something that is then passed on.
Yes.
And to the point of War's End, the book, right?
Right.
And
yes.
your father's comment about hope to God that we never have to do that again, right?
Yes.
If you do not recall and remember history and take the time to, in reverence, remember it and document like we just did today, okay, there is no record of what we should remember.
Yes. George Santayana, who said those who are, yes. don't remember history are doomed to repeat it.
Okay. Yeah. Terry, I'm sorry. I just needed to – I wanted to remind people why we do this. And this is, again, happy accident that this is the way that this has unfolded as a show.
Yeah.
But we welcome this every week. We don't want to be so tight on it that we don't allow for this to happen.
Sure.
So tell
final,
me –
final story here as
well,
we wrap
up. I have a story and then I have a plug. Let me do the plug first.
Do the plug. Right. Yeah,
beautiful
do the plug.
Friend named Laura Dietz, who lives in Corona Del Mar, who has spearheaded this amazing effort to bring the Iwo Jima Memorial, a memorial, to the West Coast and to be placed on Camp Pendleton.
Mm-hmm.
And she's worked furiously for years on this thing, and we hope to have it done for the 70th anniversary, which will be next year. I think, was it 70th? I don't remember the exact year,
like
but... The website is called Marines on Iwo Jima, and that's spelled IWOJIMA.com. So I
we'll
just
to,
want
to come back and tell a story there because that is an amazing tale
in
itself.
If we do that,
Iwo Jima.
If we put this, and it's going to be right on the 5 freeway, and it's going to be lit up, and it's going to be one of the most beautiful sights you'd ever see driving, you know, up and
again,
down.
Again, to remember.
I'm checking the website out, guys. Anybody who's listening, go check it out. It's
Marines on Iwo Jima.
Right. It's beautiful.
It's amazing.
And it's needed.
And
we need to remember these things.
Well, I know a lot of people probably know, but there's also a younger generation that may be listening. Okay, so just to give you a visual reference, you've seen this memorial, Iwo Jima Memorial, forever and ever. You might not remember.
The men raising the flag.
The men raising the flag on Iwo Jima. And so this is a similar situation in a glass box, with flags around it. And it's a museum behind it. So, yeah, check out Marines@iwojima.com. And Terry, I'm going to put out the invite right now. You know, Paul kind of answered.
Thank you.
Bring her along and let's talk about it.
Because that's a whole other story, the whole Iwo Jima.
She's local and this lady is just an amazing person.
We'll schedule her for our Veterans Hour next month, maybe.
That'd be great.
Deborah, if you're listening, just reach out to Terry and schedule that for us, please.
Okay. Last story. Take us out with a story.
Okay, I forget what it was. Oh, okay. So my dad dies and.
How long ago did he die?
Oh, I don't remember. 10 years ago.
Okay, a while ago.
I don't remember.
Right.
But anyway. This guy from the Chicago Tribune wrote a full-page article on my dad.
As well he should have.
And I read it. My brother sent it to me, and I read it. And I said, it was just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. And I called him up, and I forget his name, unfortunately. But I said, I really appreciate what you did to write that article. I mean, that was very impressive. He says, I was on Tinian when your father was there.
Oh,
he said, I was a war correspondent for Time magazine, so I knew your dad. And he said, and he gave me another history lesson that lasted about 4 hours, I couldn't believe it. But anyway, at the very end, he said, and you can see this on YouTube now. Now, when he was telling me this, YouTube wasn't available. But he said, do you know what happened at the very end? He said, MacArthur ordered the tallest, we had about, you know, a motor of ships. We had probably had 4 aircraft carrier groups out there.
Yeah.
He ordered the tallest Navy men in the entire fleet that was in the Pacific to come aboard the Missouri. Okay,
for the Japanese surrender.
Exactly. And what he did was he had lined them up. He's telling me the story along the gangplank leading up to where they're going to sign.
Oh my goodness!
And I'm saying, you know, just psychologically to think, what were you thinking?
To make them feel even smaller,
right? Okay. Now you can see it on YouTube.
Yep.
You can actually look it up, the signing of the Missouri, and the Japanese get off their boat, and they have these 10-gallon hats on that are like 30-gallon hats, you know, and they still come up to the chest of the sailors.
The stovepipe hats they would wear in those days. Yeah.
And it's just a, you know, he told me this story years ago, and now YouTube came out, and then I actually saw it, and I go, he wasn't lying to me. Yep. I mean, there it is. It's the most
psychological warfare.
Psychological warfare, even in surrender.
Yep. And on the flip side, the Japanese could not get anybody to do it. This was the height of humiliation. The Japanese
unconditional surrender.
Could not accept this. They were willing to fight to the death. Even at that moment, there were officers saying, no, we'll continue the fight as a guerrilla war, and that's where the emperor himself had to come out and do this.
That's right.
And they had to find some low-level guy to come and sign it because everybody resigned and quit. Nobody would sign the papers. And the guy that came on had a limp, as I remember.
But it's
even worse. Yeah. He himself looked damaged.
But,
you know,
I didn't even know there were 13 different countries that signed that thing.
Yeah,
Australia, China. I mean, it's really
fascinating.
And
this is in 1945. This is before visuals were so important. And yet, even in that small circle of people paying attention, being there, those psychological elements were at play.
MacArthur was known for that. You know, the wading ashore at Philippines and all this stuff.
I will say, Terry, I mean, I did a little bit of research just on your dad's book. And, you know, your dad, that book is considered controversial by some because it defended the decision to drop the bombs.
Yes.
Okay. And at some point, I'm sure that was not a very popular position. I think we have softened a little bit more and we look at things a little bit more realistically as a society, especially with the challenges we face today.
Right.
But that was one. I also wanted to add that there was something that was interesting about it. And it may have been when the B-29 was actually, you know, when he basically screened off part of that runway.
Mm-hmm.
There was something about him actually meeting with Charles Lindbergh.
Oh, yes.
Charles Lindbergh he met, too?
Yeah,
oh, my God.
Yeah. Oh,
and I'm doing that for Paul's effect.
Who didn't he know? Okay. Okay. So when they were in Eglin, shortly after Paul Tibbetts had flown in, I forgot all about that.
Lucky Lindy.
He came in to Eglin, and he said, hey, I hear you got this new plane, a B-29. And he was my dad's hero.
Oh,
I mean, my
course,
dad.
Yeah.
I mean, every kid, you know,
the number one aviator in the world.
Right.
Right.
So he says, I really like to take out that B-29 you have out there. And Tibbetts said to Lucky Lindy, he said, let me give you one of my best pilots again. And my dad said he was beaming inside because he didn't know that Tibbetts looked at him that way.
Yeah.
And so he took Lindy up. And gave him a couple hops, and
Lindy hop, right?
Yeah,
no
a couple of flights.
No pun intended.
Yeah,
it was a dance.
And and Lindy came back and said to Tibbetts, he goes, "You have one fine pilot there." So I mean,
this is a couple of years after your dad took that first trip in that plane for $2, right? It wasn't
couple
that
of
long.
Years.
Yeah, it wasn't that long.
Couple
after.
Of years.
So here you are. You've never been in a plane. You get in a plane. You realize again to the show's thing about passion, the pursuit of passion, right? That this is what you want to do for the rest of your life. Your national friggin' hero that you look up to when it comes specifically to the field of choice is a person you're actually taking around 2 years after you basically get your wings.
I mean, it's gotten all about
crazy.
That.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. Crazy. And again, I found something that was interesting, again, relevant to the pursuit of your passion throughout your life. Here's your dad. He's out of military. I think he worked in the leather industry.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And here's your dad still involved, because I saw something about the fact that he actually flew in some air shows.
Oh, all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
So here's a perfect example of, you know, not only being pursuit of passion, but here's a gentleman who actually was at key moments of history,
yes.
if not involved firsthand in key moments of history.
Yes.
So how the heck – well, I'm not going to say how the heck because I know the answer, right? So what happens to children of a person like that? Do they go into the military?
Yes,
Karen?
They do. I have a brother my brother Joe, who just last year, the year before, was an enlisted Marine.
Yeah,
I told him not to do it, but he did it anyway. came back and went to college, became an officer in the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
And was involved in the Kuwaiti thing.
Yeah. Desert Storm.
As a reservist, yeah. Yes. And then joined the Air National Guard in Massachusetts after that.
Yep.
And retired a full board colonel. I have another sister that's a lieutenant colonel still in the National Guard.
Yeah.
Who traffics KC-135s throughout the world. I had a brother that was in the service, and I, of course, being around airplanes all my life, wanted to fly jets. And
A common friend of ours basically told me to say hello to T-Bird. Which I believe is your call sign.
Yeah. In fact, most people know me as T-Bird, not as Terry.
Yeah. So I appreciate
given to me by my dad, by the way.
T-Bird by your dad.
Yeah.
See,
yeah, because of an airplane. My dad nicknamed everybody in our family. And I think in 1956 when I was born, either the T-Bird had come out or there was an airplane called the T-Bird. But either way, I want to say the airplane because that sounds better. But
it's actually
named
after it's also name of the gang in Greece, by the way.
I don't know about it.
I don't know if you knew that. Okay. It's kind of like, okay. So interestingly enough, I think your brother Joe actually also promotes. He goes on and talks about your dad.
Dad's airplane is actually at Wright Pad Air Force Base in Ohio. And beautiful, beautiful Air Force
restored
Museum.
Restored completely, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And what was ironic about that is I got to go there a couple of years ago with one of my daughters and my niece, and it's all locked up, and you can't get in it, but I convinced the guy to let me in because of the family. But he said, don't go in the cockpit. And, of course, that's the first thing I did was get in the cockpit. I said, what's he going to do, cut my hair and throw me out of here?
How did it feel to be sitting in your dad's
Well, place? I want to tell you something very interesting. My dad liked to smoke cigars. And the smell of his cigar was still in the cockpit.
Wow.
That was the most. That's the thing that
amazed
me the most.
I just got chills.
We got to end right there.
Yeah, I think we're going to end
it. Amazing.
And we're going to end it right there. Thank you, T-Bird. Thanks, Terry Sweeney.
My pleasure.
And thank you for taking us on this ride.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And,
it's wonderful.
And come back again, please.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for joining us this week. And
Give us the plug for the book and all that again.
The name of the book, you can get it on Amazon. It's out of print, but you can get it still on Amazon at one of those bookstores. It's called War's End by Charles Sweeney. And the name of the website, again, is marinesoniwojima.com.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for spending this time and sharing these stories with us.
I'm going to say also, I did find while we were just talking, if anybody's interested to actually hear specifically firsthand from Terry's dad, Charles Sweeney, there's an audio recording that's out there actually describing the Nagasaki mission preparation and execution, and it's called Nagasaki, the Commander's Voice.
Yes.
And it was made in 2005.
Was that King, the guy in
Larry
CNN,
King?
Larry King?
I didn't say.
Oh, okay.
The audio recording was done in 2002.
Okay.
Was the last one made before he passed away. So.
Oh, that wasn't Larry King.
No.
He was on Larry King, yeah.
But, and I'm sure, there's a lot of information on this.
We got to get Tom Hanks on. Call Tom Hanks right now.
and
come
Tom,
up with Tom, enough
Tom,
reasons.
Tom, if you're listening
it.
To this,
come on,
yeah,
Tom.
This is a great story. It doesn't have to be neatly packaged, boys and girls, right? This is worth telling.
That's right. It ends with the landing, and there's 3 gallons of gas.
And it ends with Terry sitting in his dad's plane, still smelling.
There you go.
Smelling. My father is a cigar smoker. I know exactly what you're talking about. I could walk into a room.
Yes.
You know, he's still alive, but I could walk into that room, heaven forbid he passes away, and I would sense him through the smell of either tobacco.
And it's only because they have it so locked up and
oh, my gosh.
Tight.
Yeah. It's everywhere.
Still do that,
right.
You
yeah.
know? It was wonderful.
So thank you again, and thanks, everybody, for joining us this week, and we'll look forward to having you along with us on The Rad Life next week. And you can email me any thoughts, ideas, feedback on these shows. Rod, R-A-A-D, period, Gantus, G-H-A-N-T-O-U-S, @gmail.com. And like us on Facebook. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to The Rad Life Radio Show with your host and age explorer, Rad Gantos, brought to you on the one and only OCTalkRadio.net. Join us again next week as we continue our journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older.